I am financial journalist Maya Fisher-French, and I had the incredible opportunity to interview scenario planner, author, and futurist Clem Sunter about his life's work. Many South Africans over the age of 50 will remember his high road and low road scenario, which created a national dialogue around what kind of future we wanted for South Africa. It provided a way forward for us, and I believe played a critical role in the transformation from apartheid to democracy. His scenario planning and insights into both local and international geopolitics has continued to provide a framework to help understand unfolding events and their potential outcomes. Clem, I just want to say thank you for having this conversation. In your scenario planning and the many people that you've met and the work you've done has really given you a unique view of South Africa's transition from apartheid to democracy. And I think that's something that's really worth talking about. But first, I want to provide a background as to why you, Clem Sunter, were the first person, one of the first people that Mandela consulted with, why the apartheid government, faced with a crossroads in 1986, wanted to hear your views about the future of South Africa, and more recent times, why you were invited to give a lecture at the Central Party School in Beijing. So let's go back to the late 1980s. This is where it all started. What was your role at Anglo, and what was happening around scenario planning at that time?
Well, it was the early 80s. It was around 1980, 81. We realized in Anglo that all metal price forecasts, including gold, diamonds, had been absolutely rotten during the 1970s. So we were looking around for another forecasting technique to capture the future. And we came across this methodology at Royal Dutch Shell that they'd been using quite successfully during the 1970s called scenario planning, where instead of trying to make a single prediction about the future, you offer different possibilities about the future within certain rules of the game and driven by certain key uncertainties. And we asked the head of the process to come out to South Africa. He was a friend of our economist in London, and to give a talk to our executive. And I happened to be the secretary of the Anglo executive at the time. And he gave a bewitching talk on scenario planning and showed how it worked and how you could capture futures which you wouldn't normally capture by just traditional forecasting. And as he said, it's not that you capture something precisely. He said it's much better to be vaguely right than precisely wrong. And that's what scenario planning really does. It gives you a feel for the opportunities and the risks inherent in the future. And Gavin really looked around the room, his eyes alighted on me, and said, "Clem, in addition to your normal mining responsibilities, would you be prepared to take on scenario planning?" And I said, "Fine, Mr. Reilly," not really knowing much about it. And we assembled teams in London under our economist, Alan Newey, there to do global scenarios for the 1990s for Anglo. And we assembled a team in Johannesburg, which mainly consisted of Michael O'Dowd and Bobby Godsell, to do South African scenarios. And they both separately worked on their projects and then presented them. And the executive was suitably impressed, and they said, "Why don't we make it a joint presentation of both the global and South African scenarios, and you, Clem, can go around the group and give a presentation." And this was in the sort of early to mid 1986. And I said, "Fine, let me have a go." So I took their presentations and turned them into a nice, catchy kind of presentation. I have to say, for example, that the words high road and low road came from Bobby Godsell and Michael O'Dowd. They were the people who thought of these words, because we had said that the scenarios should have catchy names. And certainly they made their names quite catchy by talking of high roads and low roads. So I took their material and turned it into a presentation, and I went around the group to various divisions, coal division, gold division, diamond division, giving presentations to people on the mines. And we got extraordinary feedback. And I then got a call from Mangosuthu Buthelezi, who was holding an Indaba in Durban in mid-86, saying, would I come and give a presentation of the scenarios at his function? So I went to Gavin and said, do you mind if we present the scenarios to the public? And he said, no, have a go. So off I went to Durban, gave the presentation. It was like a bomb went off. It was incredibly well received. My secretary got about 23 calls the following day from companies that had attended the talk saying, please, could you come and give a presentation at our offices? So there was obviously a need in the air.
Take us back to what was in that original scenario.
Well, it was a presentation on what were the kind of major forces in the world at the time, and the fact that Europe, America and Japan were the major players. And indeed, in scenario work, you make mistakes. And our mistake, without a doubt, was leaving out China, because China had really only just started to become the kind of giant that it is now. But we talked of the triad of America, Europe and Japan. And then we threw in all the kind of different relationships they could have. We had a scenario called Imperial Twilight, where it was about Russia, America, and Japan. And Russia ran out of money towards the end of the 1980s. You know, building weapons in a potential war with America, which, of course, never occurred. But what it did lead to was the dissolution of the Soviet Union and ushered in Gorbachev. Mm-hmm. So for a short time, you know, there was quite a good relationship between America and Russia. So it was a nice introduction to the South African scenarios, that the world could actually work together, cooperate and create a positive economic future, but equally we could have a scenario where Russia and America built up their arms into such a race that it actually destroyed Russia's financial stability.
And the high road and low road scenarios, I mean, I remember going to your talks on those as well. That was very much about the future of South Africa and where the choices South Africa was being faced with at that time.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's where the genius of both O'Dowd and Godsall came in, because what they did was really say, you know, there are two scenarios. So they didn't say there are 15 scenarios, which would complicate matters. It was very much an either-or set of scenarios with one third one. The high road was where the principal adversaries got together and negotiated a reasonable solution for South Africa. And I have to say that we didn't use the word negotiation, but when I did a presentation with some of the junior ministers of the government, at the time, they felt that it was either co-option into a kind of tricameral parliament, if you remember that was the word that was used, of a sort of black-coloured and white parliament, or a negotiation to a completely new democracy.
I want to stop you there, because that was really key. You got called in to speak to the cabinet, what, 1986?
Yeah,
just talk a little bit about how that happened and what was the response?
Well, it was interesting that after I sort of started doing public presentations, My doctor said, you're doing too much and you've got to slow down and, you know, take sleeping pills. And you must find two other people inside Anglo. So I found Michael O'Dowd, who was in corporate affairs, and Jim Bass, who was our economist. And the three of us really went around South Africa giving this presentation. And it got to the notice of a businessman, Bill Fenter, and his corporate affairs guy, Jacques Selshop, who said the cabinet should listen to this. So they organized a meeting with the cabinet. And I had F.W. de Klerk in the chair and with the rest of the cabinet. And I gave the presentation to them in, I think, November 86. And I always remember at the end, F.W. turning to Pick, bless his cotton socks, and said, do you think he should talk to, other people? Is he for real? And Pick said, yes, he is for real. And he should talk to the police, he should talk to the army, and he should talk to the parliamentarians. And I did all that. And I always was conscious of the fact that here I am, a Brit, imported from Britain, talking to these very Afrikaans group. I mean, I even talked to the Broederbond. They assembled the entire Broederbond at a university in Johannesburg. And here I was, giving my talk to the point that my mother said to me, what on earth are they listening to you? Because you weren't even born there. And it was weird, but I think one of the reasons why I got this kind of listenership from the Afrikaners was that I wasn't considered a traitor. Mm. Because, you know, this was an outsider.
You were an outsider.
Coming in and doing the talk. And so I did my sort of global introduction, followed by the high road, low road. And, yes, I was flown up to Malyaskop, which was a police camp, and they had all the generals there listening to me. And then I went to a place just outside Pretoria to talk to the armed forces. And, yeah, it definitely had its impact. And I produced a book in July 1987, which was very popular around the country. I don't know how many copies it sold, but probably around 80,000 or something like that. And then Mari Brains.
The World and South Africa in the 1990s.
Yeah, The World and South Africa in the 1990s. And then Mari Brains decided that she wanted a video of it. And so she videoed me giving the presentations and then put in all the music and everything else. And apparently at the time, it was level or had overtaken Michael Jackson's Thriller in the video shops. So it was a fantastic kind of, you know, getting the word out. I actually came across Tokyo Sekwali at the airport, and he came up and gave me a warm embrace and said that he'd watched the video in Lusaka, and there were plenty of people around him who couldn't believe that a capitalist in Anglo could give such a presentation of all the different alternatives facing the country. And he was so enthused about it. And hopefully that's how the conversation spread for all those who didn't actually attend talks that I'd been given.
You know, when listening to you, I can't help thinking, and I know you probably wouldn't say it yourself, it's always hard to blow your own trumpet, but the role that your talks did in moving us towards a negotiated peace agreement, because you showed people the consequences of not following that.
Yeah, I'd like to say that, you know, a lot of my talks were not to politicians or the cabinet or the army. They were to ordinary people. And, you know, I attended prize givings at schools. I gave talks at many, many community functions. And it was talking to ordinary people in many ways that made me actually improve what I was saying, because they would give me feedback on what their anxieties were, like sending their kids to the border at the time. It allowed me to present what the general opinion was of, you know, all the stakes and the risks and the opportunities were at the time. And it is a very important thing to do today, to talk to ordinary people, to get their views on really important political and economic matters.
You know, but Clem, what I do think as well is it's not just getting their views, which are extremely important, but they also were listening to the high road, low road scenario. So when it came to that monumental vote of do we end apartheid, which is basically what we were asked to do, you know, people had heard a different path forward.
Yeah. And as I said, you know, we, by offering the high road and low road, we changed the conversation. And it allowed them to have talks amongst themselves about a possible alternative to heading towards a civil war, which in the mid to late 1980s was a definite and feared possibility. And our high road scenario said, hey, wait, there may well be something we can do which will get us all onto a much better footing. And that's why the terms high road and low road were so powerful in the public. Well, I think the difference between us and what's happening in the Ukraine at the moment is that this all happened before the war started. Mm. You know, there had been some very nasty incidents, but there hadn't been a real war between the contending parties. And so it was nice to be able to present the scenarios. And one of the rules of the game was that neither party could win, because one side had the numbers and the other side had the arms. Mm. And therefore, it would lead to a wasteland. We called that third scenario the wasteland. If we went into the low road and the low road got really ugly, it could lead to the wasteland. And so what Michael and Bobby did, they had the political crossroads where you either went the route of co-opting nice people to create this tricameral parliament, or you went the genuine negotiation route. Mm. And that allowed you to go around the top of their chart. And that's where they're so prophetic. Further down the line, they had the dotted line saying failure of economic growth, where we went into what we called the Argentinian tango, which is where we went back into populism and dictatorship. Or we managed to get around it back onto the high road. And essentially, this chart created in the early 80s is exactly where we are now.
I was thinking, as you were saying that lack of growth.
And that's where we are now. And so it was just interesting how the thing ramped up. And I've always said, you know, that it was in the air, the kind of debate. So I never say that the high road, low road triggered the whole change in attitude. I think there were a lot of people who were already thinking we've got to change our mind. And what conversation does is it extends that transformation of mind to a sufficient number of people that it kind of gains the majority. And I have absolutely no clue what happened in the late 80s between the national government and Mandela and the ANC in Lusaka. That was much more from Sales Slabbert and others. There were one or two Anglo people like Michael O'Dowd who brought them together. I had nothing to do with that. But it definitely helped in kind of setting the scene for all these meetings
to take place.
To and probably the most important thing I say to people is that it led to, obviously, and we'll talk about it in a second, the release of Mandela and then obviously his relationship with de Klerk. But he was backed up by this superb team made up of Cyril Ramaphosa and Rolf Meyer. Mm. And they structured things in such a way that there would be a definite result. It wasn't just a national dialogue, or, you know, those vague terms that are used for kind of conversation pieces that never get anywhere. It was structured to end up with a constitution, which is quite easy for a bunch of politicians to do, because, you know, that's, you know, it's not as though you have to appeal to the public. You can get together and you can construct a democratic constitution, which is what they did. And doing the same for the economy, trying to move towards an inclusive economy and away from an exclusive economy. It's a much more subtle process requiring the input of the public. But it can be done in the same way that produces a conclusion, which you then work towards. And that's where we are today.
And you know, you mentioned obviously Mandela, and I want to take you back just a little bit back to that cabinet meeting in 1986. And you said, you know, you weren't involved in what followed, but at that time and engaging with them, did you have any idea that within 4 years Mandela would be released and we'd be moving towards a democratic? Did you get a sense that there was this desire?
Well, it was just that I was being asked to talk to such incredible groups like the Broederbond that made me think, wow, you know, here I was at the center of the thinking on apartheid and the original kind of thing, being asked to give this lecture, which was profoundly the other way, the other way. So some, you know, people had obviously talked to one another. But I wasn't very much involved in, oh, should you go here, should you go there? I was just sent a little email, or my secretary was rung saying, yeah. And interestingly, as far as Mandela was concerned, she got a phone call from a police officer in November 1989. And she said, there's somebody from the police who'd like to talk to you. So I said, oh, my heavens, what have I done? And she put him through. And I said, Munir, what can I do for you? And he said, there's a prisoner who'd like to talk to you. So I said, I don't know any prisoners, Sergeant. And he said, you know this one. So I said, who? So he said, Nelson Mandela. So I said, really? He wants to talk to me? Why? Well, he's read some of the things that you've written, and he's heard about you from others, and he'd really like to have a morning with you in January. So I said, well, when? So the officer said, anytime.
His diary's open.
Anytime. And so off I went, I think it was January the 8th, and had this amazing morning from about 9 o'clock when he met me on the doorstep of his cottage, because he was no longer in a cell, he was in a cottage in Victor Verster in Paarl, and all the way up, and he gave me lunch, because lunch was sort of wheeled in, and he gave me lunch, and we turned more into a social conversation, and then I left at 2 o'clock.
And what was it that he wanted to speak to you about? What was it? Was it your scenario planning?
Absolutely, the future, yeah. Mm. He wanted to... I mean, one of the things he said, he'd obviously picked it out of the book, The World in South Africa in the 1990s. But he said, one of the things I really liked was something you didn't write, you quoted it. And it was by Deng Xiaoping, the Chinese premier, where he said, I don't care if a cat is black or white as long as it catches mice. Mm. And that was absolutely his attitude, pragmatism. Mm. Pragmatism and reconciliation, that was the other major force. He really did want to reconcile the races, and that's why there was such a row when he decided to go to that Rugby World Cup and hand over the prize to François Pienaar and do everything as well as anybody could do it, because that was his true belief, was the reconciliation of the races. So in a funny way, it, completely different to Russia and Ukraine, because neither of those two leaders wants reconciliation with the other side.
And, you know, I want to go back to another moment, huge historic moment, of course, was 9/11, which changed geopolitics.
Yeah.
And I remember so well, I have to tell you, going to one of your talks just soon after that, because your book, The Mind of a Fox, had come out.
Yeah.
And you had in that actually predicted the possibility of a terrorist attack.
Yeah, it was the book which introduced hedgehogs and foxes to scenario planning. A hedgehog being, according to a Greek poet called Archilochus, a hedgehog being a person who knows one thing, like Plato knows one model of the world, and a fox who changes his mind and adapts every day, like Aristotle, who was more of a scientist and allowed evidence to come in and change his mind. Scenario planners were, you know, the people who changed their minds, adapted their opinions about the future as the evidence came in from the present. And that's exactly the way I do it now with the flags. You know, what is the state of the flag? Is it looking better? Is it looking worse? And how does that affect the kind of mainstream scenarios for the world and for South Africa? Whereas, you know, a hedgehog says, we've got to have a forecast for our strategic plan. Let's put the most intelligent people together to make that forecast. And then based on that forecast, you produce a business or any institution's strategic plan. And I have to say, to this day, most people adopt the hedgehog approach of doing that. They don't like looking at different scenarios and then saying, how would the strategic plan change, you know, or be adapted? But the book, The Mind of a Fox, was about the model using the original elements of Piers' advice, the rules of the game, the key uncertainties, the scenarios. Then what are your options in combating the scenarios, and what are your decisions? Because there's no point in having a meeting without decisions. And that model became very popular in the book. But as a way of illustrating it, we wrote a letter to George Bush. And the book was published in June 2001. And we said, dear Mr. Bush, your presidency will be much better if you think like a fox rather than a hedgehog, and you look at the possible risks to your presidency, and one of them is the idea of a massive terrorist attack, possibly using nuclear weapons, which had been sold to those terrorist groups, on one of the major Western cities. And of course, the attack happened 3 months later, with 9/11, not with nuclear weapons, but with ordinary planes. Mm-hmm. And I was actually rung up about 6 months after 9/11. They'd done a literature search in the State Department and the CIA and discovered that no other book in the world had been written saying precisely that to the president. And I said at the time, in answer, I said, we didn't know it was going to happen on that particular day. And the whole methodology is about being vaguely right rather than precisely wrong. And we did have three flags. The first flag was in the late 1980s, religion became a source of war, particularly with fundamental Islam, Judaism, and Christianity being in the state they were in. And that you could see terrorist incidents in the 1990s, which there were plenty of. And that came from one of the Shell people who'd been to Saudi Arabia and had attended some of the courses at the more fundamental school. The second flag was the growing sophistication and strategies of those terrorist movements during the 1990s in you know, doing these attacks on the West. But the third one was a very specific flag, which was 1998. Al-Qaeda attacked the American embassy in Tanzania and Kenya. And so we thought that it had become, that, you know, the risk had definitely increased. And of course, the problem with the CIA is they didn't think that Al-Qaeda was capable of mounting such a sophisticated event of training pilots, putting them together, sending them onto aircraft, doing all the things that needed to be done to make 9/11 happen. And it is in The Art of War by that Chinese guy. One of the things is never underestimate your enemy. And guess what? Mossad did exactly the same with Hamas. Mm. They simply hadn't, even though there was an agent called V, a lady, who had witnesses around Gaza and who said the drilling patterns of Hamas have changed, which makes it look more like a group event than a series of individuals. That was ignored higher up the command because they just didn't think Hamas could do it. And so it was an incredibly good way of getting across to people that the methodology that Chantal and I were advocating looked at futures which most people would ignore.
And, you know, this very much looked at the threats facing a country as well as, I suppose, the mindset, because I imagine you would have thought of George Bush more as a hedgehog than a fox. And was this one of the reasons that you were invited? Was it this book, this experience, to lecture at the Central Party School in Beijing, which is the leadership academy for the Chinese Communist Party? I mean, yeah. Wow.
Yeah, I just happened to be there on Anglo business, and one of the people that I was asked to meet was the deputy head of the school. We got talking about scenario planning, and he said, gosh, that would be a very nice thing to add to the 5-year planning process that we do at the school to create China's 5-year economic plans. And so I was invited along with the head of the Anglo office there and an interpreter to go to the school to talk to them. And I always remember arriving at the school in a black Audi and the chauffeur saying, I hope we are expected, because there was a whole bunch of the People's Liberation Army outside the front gate. And anyway, we were allowed in. Apparently very few foreigners are allowed into the school. And that morning I went through the whole lecture in English and Chinese, because they had their own interpreter, we had an interpreter, of the technique of scenario planning and the rules of the game, the key uncertainties, the scenarios and all that. And they did ask questions in Chinese, although at one stage in the audience I talked about Bush, and one of the listeners said, Bush is a maverick. And I thought they do understand English. And so we did the lecture. And then after lunch, I said, we must do a proper practical session. What is worrying you the most? And they said, actually, you know, we own $1.75 trillion worth of American bonds. I mean, even today, $1.75 trillion. I don't know that they own that much. And we're afraid that America might go into recession, and that these bonds could fall in value. And so we did a scenario around an American recession. And then I said, what is the principal flag that would indicate that the recession could take place? And they went into a cabal and came up with a fabulous flag. They said, it's property prices. It's the fact that the biggest asset of an American consumer for her or him is their house. And if they fall in value, they'll stop spending. And since consumer spending is 2/3 of American GDP, it'll definitely lead to a recession. And there just happened to be an index at the time called the Case-Shiller Index, which was then chosen to watch to see if the recession scenario was increasing in probability. And in the last quarter of 2006, it kind of leveled off. And in the first quarter of 2007, it went down. So by March, April 2007, they were definitely giving a high probability to a recession scenario. They never called it, a collapse, or anything as dramatic as what happened when the market fell in 2007 and 2008. But it absolutely demonstrated the validity of the model and having that flag in mind. I don't know what they did, whether they upped the internal economy to make up for the loss of American exports during 2007 and 8. They never told me. But it was a great case. There was, at one stage in the morning, a classic interchange when I asked the assembled audience, is there any scenario where you develop into a full-blown democracy? To which one person stuck up his hand and says, tell me, Mr. Sunter, do you have a democracy in Anglo-American? In the afternoon, after we concluded the debate on the scenarios, they said, would I like a tour of the other classrooms and the school, just to see what it looked like since so few people from overseas visited it. And I said, yes. And so I went around the classrooms and there was quotations on the wall, all in Chinese. And so I said, whose are these quotations? And they said, no, well, it's not Mao Zedong. And I said, oh, really? Because you kind of see him in Tiananmen Square. And they said, no, it's Deng Xiaoping, because he represents how we got from where we were in 1978 when he became president to where we are today. Because he made two points, which we put in these quotes. Firstly, he said we must improve our infrastructure, the ports, the bridges, the telephone system, the railways and the airlines to act as a platform for a much faster growing economy. And then secondly, he said, we must allow ordinary Chinese citizens to create wealth for themselves, which went entirely against the traditional Communist Party system. And those two things they felt took them from the 100th ranked economy where they were in 1978 to number five in 2006 to number two today. And I feel very, very strongly that absolutely applies here, that we've got to listen to what Deng Xiaoping said. And unfortunately in China, I don't think the leaders have felt so strongly about that second point as he did. And it really, really, really helped China to become, you know, a global champion. And we should have exactly the same kind of philosophy here in South Africa. One final point, my wife and I went to the British Embassy that night and they said, oh, where have you been? So I said, oh, the Central Party School. And they said, what? I said, yes. And they said, we've been trying to get there for years. And I said, well, maybe it's because I'm South African that they invited me to do this presentation for them. But it shows that it was just one of those lovely opportunities.
It's evolved, it's changed. We now talk about flags. What are the flags now?
Well, the principal flag is the religious flag of what is going to happen in Israel. And I don't think people know because, you know, large chunks of Gaza have been completely destroyed. I mean, it's going to take years to rebuild that. And the idea of then putting everybody into some kind of refugee camp in the south of Gaza, you're not going to fit 2 million people and keep them alive in just one small spot. And obviously people are talking of sending them to another country, but, you know, that will be considered wrong. But I actually don't know what's going to happen. And also, I don't know what's going to happen with Iran, because Iran obviously still has nuclear capability, despite what the Americans and the Israelis have done. And, you know, they're looking at rebuilding it and so forth and so on. So it's a flag which is very cloudy at the moment.
And this was a flag, though, you raised a while ago.
Well, in 23, before it happened. And it was because Israel was so divided in June 23 when I wrote the article. You know, Netanyahu, because of his legal problems himself, was trying to weaken the judiciary and had and it caused major demonstrations in Jerusalem. That and West Bank settlers were still being allowed to take over, Arab land. And, you know, the West Bank is still a major issue. People talk about Gaza all the time, but the West Bank is still a major issue. So that was the reason that flag is the number one flag. The second flag is the leadership flag, because I introduced that more recently into the portfolio, maybe 2 or 3 years ago, because I felt that whoever is leader at the time actually can really affect your life. Like my dad, who was working in a bank in the late 30s. And his life was completely turned upside down, because he had to join the army in 1939-40. And luckily he survived the war, came out in 45 and became a stockbroker. But that's how much a foreign leader can change your circumstances. And I felt that this was a genuine flag. Even when Biden was president, you had Biden, Xi, and Putin. They never talked to one another. They never did anything. Now you've got Trump as leader. So watching the leadership flag and whether we are going to see some form of coming together or not, I don't know, because my problem with Trump is that he's now talking about BRICS being sort of very, very counter to NATO and to G7 and to the West. And so, I don't know whether we're going to suddenly see, a flip-flop, because Trump has already flip-flopped on some issues, so maybe he'll flip-flop on this. But that's the crunch, is whether these leaders are actually going to get together. He hasn't done much damage yet, because the markets are still up and all that kind of stuff. But there's so many different issues out there. There's a lot of uncertainty.
Clem, I think you need to go and do some scenario planning with them and just show them the high road and the low road.
Yeah, maybe I should. Maybe I should. But then, the most, for me, meaningful flag is the green flag of climate change. Whilst all this stuff has been going on over the last few years, climate change has gone back down to being a non-issue. But it's huge. It's huge. And, I hate referring to one particular event, because people will say, oh, no, but how can you relate the general point of climate change to that one? I'd say you can't. That's why you've got to be vaguely right. And like those, we had this terrible, terrible floods in Texas down particular rivers, and one was into this girl's camp. And, if they'd actually done a proper thing on climate change, they would have said, the risks have gone up, that this can happen. And it's still happening in other parts of the United States, that you're getting record rainfalls and this and that. And therefore, you've got to be careful. You've got to be careful where you build your house. You've got to be careful where you put a camp. These things you've got to become more careful about. And so, the climate change flag, the green flag, as I call it, has become a really major issue. And another flag which I have in the portfolio, again, since I wrote Flag Watching in 2016, is the Porous Border flag, where, millions of immigrants are trying to get into rich countries. And I know that Trump has temporarily reversed that trend, but certainly it hasn't been reversed in Europe. And I don't know what they're going to do about it. I simply don't know what they're going to do about it. But it is a flag, because it's a major force in the world today. And the last one, which for me is huge, is what I call national debt. Because what happened after the crash of 2008 was obviously a lot of new money came into the system to revive it. And we've had cheap money during the sort of 2010s. And then we had COVID, which meant more money coming into the system. So the actual ratio of national debt to GDP has gone rocketing up around the world. And at some point, interest rates on bonds are going to rise. And then, is that going to create another financial crisis, because you know, Japan, the interest rate on bonds has gone a lot in the last few months, and they do have a very high ratio of national debt to GDP. I mean, America, I think even without Trump's $3 trillion that his latest beautiful plan will cost, their GDP is around $28 trillion and their debt is around $36 trillion. So they're way above 100%, around about maybe 125%. And in the 90s, people said you must not go beyond 60%. So that could be another real flag to watch.
Eventually, you can't keep kicking the debt can down the road.
But I don't want to. I don't want to, you know, create the, one of the real things why the high road, low road worked is that we offered a positive scenario. The last thing a scenario planner should be is a doomsayer, and just offer negative scenarios. So we've got new technologies coming into play. We've got there's plenty of good things going on in the world, and therefore the idea of a friendly planet world where we get back to sharing technologies and everything else must not be discounted. It can happen with new leadership, so that leadership flag is very important.
Well, Clem, I was thinking exactly that. I thought at the time of the high road and the low road, it was the leadership who made the choice of which road they're going to follow. And that is what we need today. You can put up the flags, you can show them, but ultimately the leaders need to decide, are we going to obliterate this planet or are we going to work together for a future? And I think that's probably where we are at the moment.
No, but you're dead right about that, because I always say to people, you know, who focus on Nelson Mandela, I say, F.W. de Klerk, who came from the right wing in Afrikanerdom, actually gave up power to form a proper democracy. So he underwent a major change that many, many other leaders would not do. He would have stuck to his guns. And it's only because of those two people that we managed to, you know, get to where we are, which is, as I said, we've now got another challenge, which is the economic challenge here.
Well, yes, we got the political, we sort of seem to navigate the politics to a degree where we are now, but certainly the economic growth. And I mean, maybe this is a good way to conclude just on the economic growth. If you had to go back to that scenario in the 1990s where you had that low economic growth model, that's where we are.
Well, I personally want to see a second get-together. But, you know, GNU has got to do it properly. What it, you know, just talking of a national dialogue is not going to work. They're going to have to get some entrepreneurs, real business people together. They've got to set deadlines and what the major things to do, which can possibly create a new class of entrepreneurs in this country, a whole new generation of entrepreneurs in this country, how we can meld the mainstream economies into the township economies, how they can come together with far less barriers to them, what we can do to obviously increase our exports, because we do need that increase in exports. And yes, we've got to try and uplift everybody's life, but it's got to be done in a way that really prioritizes economic growth. And that the only thing that does that is entrepreneurship. In America, the latest statistic is that two-thirds of the new jobs, every month they announce a new, two-thirds of the new jobs in America are created by small business. So yes, there's a huge sort of trend going on that big business is not like what it was in the last century, where it created hundreds of thousands of jobs, particularly here in the mining industry. And in America, it was the motor industry or whatever it was. You know, more and more people are looking to small and medium-sized business for employment. We've got to find out why and how we can now get that large group of, you know, informal employed people people into better jobs, but not just as a wafting conversation, but as something which you put, you put time limits on. And I'd like to see GNU do this. You know, I don't want to see the breakup of GNU, but you know, I just don't like a lot of the rhetoric that I hear coming out from both sides, the ANC and the DA. Because for me, it at last combines the belief by the ANC that you want to uplift the life of ordinary people with the DA concept that the only way you're going to do that is through entrepreneurship and small business.
Economic growth.
And you know, one of the points we made in the original kind of portrait of a winning nation, we used to call it in the mid-80s, we said is small government, that you cannot have government making the major commercial decisions. It's got to be people who understand those businesses. And, you know, to get away from that aspect of socialism, that it's got to be government everywhere. It can't. You've got to let these guys do their own thing. So that's why I quite like the hybrid version that we have at the moment, if it can stick together. One of the reasons that I still have a positive scenario for South Africa is that, or, you know, the high road continuing, is that at ground level, lots of people work together and produce world-class services and products. And there's no mention of colour or any kind of discrimination at all. They just work as a team. And it's that kind of relationship which gives me hope, that it's the politicians who are arguing with one another all the time. But, you know, when you get down to the level of ordinary people, they very much can get together without any problem at all, and actually produce a product efficiently in a world-class way. And I'd really like this to be the basis of the new South Africa, when we've got a proper economic plan to make the economy inclusive.
Excellent. Well, I just want to say thank you so much for sharing your story. And I think it's just, yeah, for me, it was really astounding. I've known you for many years. I've known your, you know, I've attended many of your talks, but linking it together and being able to see the bigger picture and just understanding that how incredible that high road, low road scenario was, I think, in creating a blueprint for South Africa to move forward, I think was pivotal. It was very, very important. So thank you for that role.
Well, put it like this, and I that's where I always go back to my fellow colleagues in Anglo, that my real role in this whole affair was to popularize what they actually wrote about. So I was a good storyteller rather than, I wasn't the basic researcher at all. I was just a good storyteller, and it happened to be the right moment to do it.
Well, thank you for your storytelling, Clem.
Okay.